Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 461.RV1620, certificate number 50204. Ferdinandea.
Have you ever considered that if we're talking to listeners millions of years in the future, that that even the continents of this planet will not look like they did in our time?
I have considered that.
How recently?
I think about the future.
How often do you consider it?
I think about it all the time, and I imagine. So, do you believe that there's a universal grammar? Are you a Chomskyite? Do you believe that there is some kind of fundamental language?
I think I don't.
Because a million years from now, futurelings have to be communicating via a completely different methodology.
It's going to be flashing lights or colors or smells.
There can't possibly be language as we know it. And so they have to be translating this into some sort of squid ink language.
What's the squid ink for on fleek?
On fleek. On fleek.
Really? Squid ink is just a French accent?
Yeah. On fleek. Well, you know, do squids have eyebrows?
You would have to find the nearest analog to having really on-point tentacle hygiene or something.
On fleek. But I do think about the future, the geographical evolution of the world and what that portends for the corporeal nature of futurelings.
Because the continents are really, you know, the outlines of the Earth are just something we take for granted. We assume that
the North is north and south is south.
And this is, well, we've talked about that. The poles won't change, but also that the continents will physically move around on the plates. I'm looking at a map of what Earth might look like in 250 million years. And South America has now split off, and it's an island.
Right. That makes sense.
And Africa has kind of floated north to the degree that Brazil is now, the easternmost point of Brazil is now kind of kissing the Cape of Good Hope.
The Atlantic Ocean?
Atlantic Ocean is just a little lake now.
Little tiny squashed lake.
It's not tiny. It's a huge Mediterranean-sized sea.
Right. But
or bigger, but it is
North America has continued on its inexorable path to crush Spain.
Has that been our goal?
Ever since,
if we can't win the World Cup, we're going to literally do it.
I mean, ever since the sinking of the Maine.
I mean, it might actually be two supercontinents. One actually good one with all the Northern Hemisphere continents. You know, the Americas in this version, the Americas have crashed together with Africa and Eurasia. And there's kind of a triangular, what's left of the Indian Ocean is now a little lake between South America and then the other lesser Southern Hemisphere continents, Australia and Antarctica have formed their own little Southern Hemisphere.
For futurelings that still have Google, how do they look this up?
Oh, I just looked for future continents maps and found a few projections. Of course, we don't know. We can follow current trends.
Right. But somewhere along the line.
But we're getting back to some Pangaea-like world.
So now why was it in the interest of the continents to have moved apart from Pangaea? And then it's only to return.
It's just a screensaver. You just happened to be born at the moment when the screensaver looked like this. Everything kept bouncing around.
I see.
For a while, all the little globs were globbed together, and then they weren't.
Right.
Neither one is the natural or steady state of the world.
And does this all account for the rising seas?
No, that's a separate variable. I mean, that's what we'll see sooner, right? I mean, none of us will live to see any of these outlines look any different than they are today, with the exception of coastal areas. If sea levels do rise within our lifetime, then we're going to see, you know, in just a few centuries, a map of Florida could look different.
I'm looking at a map.
Some islands could be gone.
Like a climate change map where half of South America, by which I mean the whole central part of South America, is underwater. And all that's left is a Andean strip and then a little kind of Brazilian mega island. That doesn't seem cool.
Usually when you get a Brazilian, there's nothing left. But
this is weird. It looks like a water redistribution because Alaska is connected to Russia in this model. So water goes up some places and down others.
Well, I think what you're seeing is plates rising faster than sea level in some places. Sea level is rising everywhere. It's just a question of where plates are rising or sinking because that happens as well. The motion is not all lateral.
Right.
But because we can't see this, none of us see anything close to a geological time frame. We think of geography as a constant.
Right. I certainly do.
If this is a desert now, it will always be a desert, even though there's some, you know, 40,000 year cycle of what shape the Sahara Desert is, for example.
Somebody on Instagram yesterday who runs an Instagram page called Seattle Back Then or something like that posted a picture where they said, here's a picture of a trolley just north of Dearborn. And I commented, I think that picture of a trolley is actually a few blocks south of Dearborn.
Could you tell?
And they said, actually, no. At which point I backed off and said, my bad. And then they replied a second time and said, oh my God, you're right. And then they expressed—
That's a phrase you never hear on the internet. My God, you're right.
Except when people write me, because I'm always right. And then they wrote and said, how could you have recognized that so fast? What kind of weirdo are you?
Are you John Roderick on this? Yeah. Or are you Seattle Fan 420 or whatever?
Yeah, right. I'm John Roderick, and I was, you know, I have no answer to that question. But geography is constant to me, and this picture from 1921 did not fool me. I knew what corner it was.
What was the tip off, by the way?
Well, the tip off was a corner of a building which they had attributed to a printing company, which has a very, very identical looking building a few blocks away.
But your keen eye was not fooled.
But I know that building to actually be a tiny corner of a building that is further south, which was a somewhat famous auto parts manufacturing building. But also, clearly, Rainier Avenue at that point was flat and had not begun the climb up the hill to Jackson that Rainier does when it passes Dearborn. I mean, it's really tough to have to correct everyone in the world.
I mean, Seattle is one place where terrain actually has changed in the last century or slightly more, just because so much dirt was moved around and regraded
as part of
build the city as we know it.
Right, a project called the Regrade, which was meant to flatten Seattle's seven hills and make it more amenable to commerce.
It didn't work.
It did not.
There's still a ton of hills. They did a lousy job.
They did, and also they finished that project immediately before the crash of 1929. So they took down this totally vibrant business area that had beautiful hotels on it and flattened it out in order to make commerce happen, and then the crash resulted in that flat area being basically one-story warehouses for the next 90 years.
But that kind of thing is relatively rare. Usually you can come back to a place 100 years later and the coastline will look as it did. The hills will be where they were. The trees will be taller.
Although Manhattan has done a considerable amount of infill mm-hmm. on the lower half of Manhattan. There have been plenty of like reclamation
projects. Urban reclamations, yeah. yeah. And more now with, you know, with real estate scarce in a lot of areas.
We've talked about the Netherlands.
Sure.
Doubling in size.
And you build islands in Hong Kong, you build islands in Dubai, you build islands places where it's crowded and you can move some dirt.
You build islands in the stream.
But sometimes islands just appear. Sometimes the earth decides it wants to be a different shape and it will bypass its usual slow bureaucratic processes for getting that done and will actually, what is there a political analogy for this? It'll declare martial law. And something will just happen.
Because of volcanism?
In most cases, volcanism. About 20 miles south of the western tip of Sicily, we now know is a single vast underwater volcano. It was long known to be a volcanically active region. Obviously, it's not far from Mount Etna. But we now know that...
Etna, I'm glad to meet you.
I'm glad you have a catchphrase for when somebody says Etna. That's good. That'll come in handy.
The snows of Mount Ida, enough to make me shudder.
What even is that?
I played Agamemnon once in a production of the Oresteia, and I still have a couple of his soliloquies in my head.
These are quotes from Euripides that you're sharing with us.
Yeah, I'm afraid
I can't believe I didn't get the reference to. So was this a hip-hop adaptation?
That's the thing. I mean, it's a translation upon a translation upon a translation.
I want to see Lin-Manuel Miranda's rhyming Oresteia. It's volcanically active down there. It's, people have long known that there's kind of fumaroles and spouting sulfurous stuff in that part of the Mediterranean. I'm sure it's the origin for a lot of Greek myths about
dragons,
cyclops and sea monsters and whatnot.
Right.
But we now know that really the whole area is one massive submerged volcano that some Italian geologists now call Empedocles.
Empedocles.
Which is a cool volcano name.
It is.
It's named for the philosopher who first arranged matter into the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. I assume because an underwater volcano has at least three of those.
Earth, air,
not a lot of
fire.
Air. Not a lot of air.
Well, gas.
I guess. There you go. All four. There you go.
Yeah.
Good job, Empedocles. It's huge. The volcano is about the size of the District of Columbia.
Hmm.
It's about as tall as the Eiffel Tower. From the sea bottom, yes. But that is not quite tall enough to clear sea level in the Mediterranean under normal circumstances.
I'm surprised that the Mediterranean at that point is only as deep as the Eiffel Tower. That seems not very deep, actually, for a sea.
You're not wrong. The Mediterranean is a mile down on average.
Right.
And some parts are, the Calypso Deep off the coast of Greece is almost 3 miles down. But this point is, for whatever reason, this is shallow enough at this point between Sicily and Tunisia that there are seamounts that approach sea level.
Wow, that's impressive.
And
I mean, I guess there's a giant island right there called Sicily.
Yeah, it's only 20 miles off Sicily.
It's not unprecedented.
Right. You could put an island there, and in fact, someone did. The modern history of Ferdinandea begins in the summer of 1831.
Great summer.
Do you remember it well?
Oh, it was nice.
Well, it wasn't so great off the coast of Sicily, where there were some unusual tremors. And sailors and coastal people started smelling sulfur. And it got bad enough that the smoke from the sulfurous soot started to turn silverware black.
Smoke from sulfurous soot, sailor's delight.
Soil silverware. and of course, this is a part of the world where that happened pretty often. But the bubbling and the bubbling sea starts to turn into a big column of smoke.
Huh.
Which scares residents who even as recently as the 19th century are starting to think this might be a sea monster because that's my default assumption.
Sure. What else is it going to be
when something goes wrong?
Sea monster.
They would see sailors would pass by and see dead fish floating around and people would think, sea monster.
Well, the thing about a sea monster is of course it would stay in one location and take weeks to surface.
Because it's so big, because it's lazy.
It's a monster.
It's trying to lure you into your unawares.
Uh huh. Trying to lure you by killing fish and
blackening silverware. And then when you least expect it, out it pops.
Oh, you coquette.
What happens instead is 2 weeks after the first sulfur bubbles appear, a little patch of land suddenly pops up. In the Mediterranean, 20 miles off the coast of Sicily, where no land had been before.
Kind of used to this a little bit in the South Pacific. It seems to be a thing, but Sicily's, wow.
Just a new part of Italy appearing is unusual. And for the next couple of months, this, what starts out as a little rock starts to grow. It is, of course, Empedocles spitting out all kinds of, a big pile of volcanic rock.
Hot and then cooling.
And then
rock.
It hits the Mediterranean and you get basalt. And so this island begins to grow.
Basalt makes really bad vacation turf.
Do you have this from experience?
Yeah, it's like really sharp. It doesn't even look that bad. It looks like something you could kick, but if you try, it hurts. It's solid.
I mean, anybody who's been to Hawaii knows, there's a very thin layer of lush greenery and white sand above just punishing basalt and pumice that just wants to scrape you up.
I still have a scar right here from my most recent basalt scrape.
So as the months go on, the island grows and grows. It's soon high enough to be visible from the coast of Sicily.
Wow.
I mean, it eventually reaches a elevation of about 200 meter or 200 feet, this new pile of basalt. And it's a few miles around. It's big enough that it has the tall mountain on the northeastern side, and there's two little ponds in the center, one red and one yellow, because of, I guess, different bacterial activity. So suddenly there is new geography in the middle of the Mediterranean, and it's appeared at a very tactical location. It's very near Mediterranean shipping lanes.
Right.
It's right between,
sort of close to
Italy and Africa.
Tunisia.
Right. And everyone's afraid, what if this is the beginning of a land bridge between Europe and Africa? What if the Strait of Sicily suddenly stops being a strait?
Oh.
And now Europe is connected to Africa. So even back then, fear of the developing world is a huge part of policy.
And Malta is right there. There's a lot going on in that little Strait of Sicily.
It's very strategic. The all the European powers that are guarding against each other have their own little islands where they can base shipping. But this new island is uniquely well situated to keep an eye on anybody going through the Strait of Sicily.
And in 1831, you're still using cannon to guard straits. And so this, as a cannon emplacement, could be pretty useful.
I guess you'd need a place to, if it becomes a real island, it becomes a place, maybe it has a harbor, you can take ships there, maybe you can take on water and supplies. So Europe's powers mobilize to claim this brand new island for them.
Oh, this is exciting.
A British Navy vessel gets there first and calls it Graham Island in honor of the first Lord of the Admiralty. It's been a while since you could name new stuff on Earth, right?
It's exciting.
Suddenly there's a new part of Europe.
Graham Island.
That can be named. And in fact, if you look at the Wikipedia entry for Ferdinandea, it is still called Graham Island.
I wonder if in the United Kingdom there's a short list of names that are reserved for naming any new land that's discovered. Like Graham was next on the short list.
The thing about living in the West Coast is you see just how much of our landscape is just named after random British naval guys who were due a favor or
something.
Right,
the second navigator in James Cook's ship got a mountain named after him.
Like Vancouver and Puget and Rainier, all these people who have super famous names on maps now.
Right.
They weren't celebrities in life. But I guess that's the way to do it. Like, just be in the right place at the right time and be on a map forever.
I feel like the Brooks Range in Alaska, there were an awful lot of unnamed mountains up there. And when naming time came, it was the same kind of like gold rush of getting a mountain named after
you. Ooh, me. That's what those people do who answer those ads in Scientific American about getting a star named after them.
Yeah.
They don't know that's not real. But I'm not going to say Graham Island, even though that's what Wikipedia says, because that's the name of the oppressor. This is close to Sicily.
Right.
And the second people to plant a flag on the island were the kingdom of the two Sicilies.
It's nice that at this point in time, the Italians are the oppressed minority. not a people we think of now as an oppressed minority, but
no, because they're always pushing us around.
Well, and anyone that interacts with the British Empire is interacting with the oppressor. They're the oppressor.
And they got there first, just like they always do. But Italy gets there second, and King Ferdinand of Sicily, Ferdinand II, names the island Isola Ferdinandea, like Ferdinand's Island.
After himself.
A real ego trip, yes.
Right, right. It does seem like they have the better claim.
Well, it's right there.
Right.
The Spanish get there too and call it Corral. The French get there too. They compare the eruption to a champagne bottle being uncorked. That's what they think of.
Oh, well done, France. I mean, France.
That's very on brand for them.
France and Spain still have a better claim to it than England.
But England got there first.
Yeah.
It was really first past the post back then, right?
Right.
And the French call it the Ile Julia, I guess because it's July and maybe because of the July Revolution.
Ile Julia.
So four different countries have a different name for this little tiny island about the size of, what, I don't know, Central Park or something. And the conflict rages because everybody wants to make sure they're in on the ground floor just in case Ferdinandia is the big new thing. So huge diplomatic squabbles are going on. In the meantime, people want to visit. You know, this is the ultimate new vacation destination. So adventurous Europeans of all stripes go ashore on Ferdinandia.
Interesting.
The novelist Sir Walter Scott is among them. He's a bit of a romantic, I guess, and wants to see what it's like. It's a little underwhelming when you get there. It's very fragmented and soft rock. So it's like you're walking in just a field of loose stone.
You're not walking on sunshine.
No. I don't know what surface that would be that would be sunshine like.
It was grassy and wanted wear.
That's
although
right.
As for that, the passing there had warned them really about
it. It is not grassy and it doesn't want wear. It's brand new out of this is the newest rock you can get.
I see.
This is straight from the factory. It's probably still warm. But John, you and I have something in common.
What? I have something in common?
Normally, we're the original odd couple. You're so messy and I'm such an uptight neatnik.
Yep.
But we've both been guests on our friend Luke Burbank's wonderful podcast, Too Beautiful to Live.
Yeah, Luke Burbank and our other Seattle friend, Andrew Walsh.
I first met Luke when he was still doing that show on Cairo.
Yep, me too. I've been on his Cairo show.
He got me in there because he had seen me blog about meta fiction. Like I did a series of blog posts about things I thought were meta, like Arrested Development or Animal Man comics and Iranian movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to talk about meta stuff because he didn't know what it meant. And we really hit it off.
Yeah.
And I know you guys are friends as well. But it's a great show like that because I think he's a really good interviewer.
He is a great interviewer.
He's very funny.
He's funny. And, you know, the thing about Luke is he comes across as kind of a suave game show host kind of person, but he's an extremely smart, thoughtful, sensitive guy who's also a smarmy game show host.
Like when public radio needs to fill in for Peter Sagal on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, of all the smart and slightly game show hosty people in America, they pick Luke.
Yeah.
Like he's really good in that gig.
And one of the amazing things about Too Beautiful to Live is that they managed to do this show every damn day.
That's crazy to me.
As someone who podcasts and podcasts every day, Too Beautiful to Live still astonishes me. I mean, it's 90 minutes long every single day.
They have, you know, they create a great community out of their listeners, I think because of that regular contact. And they call that Luke and Andrew call that the point of the show now. Their mission is to cure global loneliness.
Whew.
Which is really
a tall order.
That speaks to our moment.
But I feel like they have it, whatever that ineffable quality is. I like being on their show. I like being in their company. And I do feel like the Too Beautiful to Live listener fan base is one of the more kind of inclusive and self-supporting groups of like internet fans I can think of. I don't think of them as a bitter and caustic group of people at all.
No, it's a great podcast. They're friends of Omnibus. You can find Too Beautiful to Live on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to Omnibus.
I mean, be careful because it's a bad drug and Luke Burbank will sap your precious bodily fluids. I don't know if I was meant to say that. I mean, he's
let's not tell everybody.
They're a dangerous threat to humanity.
They're vampires.
Kind of going off script here a little bit, but
no, it said we're supposed to mention that they're vampires.
Oh, okay.
Because if you invite them in, then it's okay.
Yeah. Don't say Luke Burbank three times. Now, interestingly, Tunisia was an Ottoman territory at this time, and I'm surprised that they also did not claim. It seems like a thing that the Ottomans would have rushed to plant a flag too.
I wonder if this is the kind of thing where our history is kind of filtered through the European diplomatic squabble over it.
Right.
The Turks were there too, but
oh, no, but that's the
who
thing.
Cares we, about that?
At the time, boy, you know, the Turks were still the real threat to Europe. I would assume that would have been...
And it would have been something to mobilize against, right?
The real scary thing, right. Because France later invaded Tunisia and took control of it as one of their... Talk about the bad guys. Talk about the colonizers. So, France there would have really inflamed a lot of passions.
Well, maybe that's why France wanted, as they would have called it, Ile Julia.
I think they did.
It's a great base for their North African expansionism.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing the French want actually is to make it into a holiday resort because, you know, so many people want to come. This is like new beachfront property. This is like Lex Luthor in the first Superman.
Right. It's their own Ibiza.
Exactly. They missed out. Ibiza's already full of like guys from...
Right. Germans and Dutch.
And new guys from Newcastle and...
Who are dancing in
Sunderland.
In big bubble-filled warehouses.
And look-alike Irish pubs. And it's, you know, it really inspires a lot of writers. I mean, Walter Scott goes there, but no fewer than three other writers produce novels based on the emergence of Ferdinand Day. Because a new island had never happened in human history, it really seems to spark people's imaginations.
Right.
James Fenimore.
A new place to get shipwrecked.
Right. Shipwreck was the number one plot MacGuffin for novels back then. The plots back then were like man versus drowning, man versus coconuts.
Right.
Man versus pirates. James Fenimore Cooper wrote not one of his greatest works, but a novel called The Crater or Vulcan's Peak.
This was at a time when people were really fast writers too. This was like of the moment, right?
You could really churn it out.
Ripped from the headlines.
I guess in a time when you really don't have a lot of other, you know, you don't have round the clock cable news. You don't really have a lot of other real time journalism. You know, the new installment of a novel would really fill in for that. It would be ripped from the headlines. It would be hot news.
Right. Serialized in punch.
Right. So James Fenimore Cooper writes The Crater about a volcanic upheaval on a new island. Alexander Dumas writes The Sparrow-Nara. And Jules Verne writes no fewer than two novels about a brand new appearing island. Most famously, The Wonderful Adventures of Captain Antifer, which is kind of, it's a Mad World style treasure hunt where... A brand new island is the jackpot. It's the secret location where the treasure was buried, but unfortunately, it had returned to the depths. So it's kind of a Tintin style twist where the you almost get the treasure and then it's gone. So Europe is just captivated by this new island, but unfortunately, it does not stick around. It is made of, again, it's kind of soft lumps of rock, and the Mediterranean is full of wind and waves. And it starts to, as soon as the eruption starts, Ferdinand Day starts getting erupted faster than it can stand.
Uh-huh.
And so within a few months, the island is gone.
Oh.
And we now know that this is a cycle that, so much for the holiday resort. We now know that this is a cycle that repeats every time there's eruptions, sufficiently large eruptions from Empedocles. We now know there were reports back to the First Punic War of stuff bubbling out of the Mediterranean there. So Fernandea comes and goes. It's like Brigadoon.
Huh.
Sometimes it's there. I think it reappeared again in the 19th century briefly, and then went away. You know, ship will sight, hey, that shoal wasn't there before. And then overnight it'll be gone. It's just a matter of when eruption is faster than erosion.
So what happens is the angle of the volcanic mount becomes untenable and it collapses on itself and gradually sort of is building, but its angle of attack needs to be.
I assume a lot of the problem is at the surface where there's actual wind and wave activity.
And that's enough to crumble to crumble it back into the
sea? Yeah, to crumble it back below the surface. Hmm. Because I think in general, it's often very close. Like in general now, Fernandea is there, but it's like 20 feet from the surface. Its later history is kind of interesting. In 1986, in April of 1986, do you remember there was a bombing of a Berlin disco that the Reagan administration linked to Libya. Gaddafi's government.
Right.
And immediately sent a bombing raid
that killed toward Tripoli. Gaddafi's adopted daughter.
Oh, is that the one?
I think.
Oh, okay. Well,
maybe that was the one for the Lockerbie bombing. I forget.
We were bombing Libya a lot back then.
Yeah,
more than you'd think. And on the way to bomb Tripoli, some U.S. planes spot something just below the surface smoking just off the coast of North Africa. And we bombed it thinking we had found Libyan submarines. And it turned out we had just bombed Fernandea.
It could have been anybody's submarine. did they like call around?
Yeah, of course you got to call around. Dimitri.
Hey, you got a submarine?
It's just the Dr. Strangelove scene.
I guess maybe it's the assumption that a Libyan submarine is steam powered.
Yeah, why is it smoking?
Chook, 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 chook.
It's tobacco smoke. They've all got like a hookah.
So we bombed Fernandea.
Would Libya have even had submarines? Now that I think about this.
No.
You don't think Libya has much of a submarine fleet.
Maybe they have some Italian like World War II vintage submarines that they've kept going that were steam powered.
This seems like maybe not great decision making on the part of a pilot.
Yeah. Or his commander back on the USS Abraham Lincoln.
But anyway, Fernandea is one of the... It's a territory that has the unusual distinction of being claimed by four countries and then bombed by the U.S. That really
God bless America.
That tells you everything you need to know about 19th century England, France, Italy, and Spain, and 20th century USA. Like, they were all excited to put a flag on it. We just wanted to bomb it before we even knew what it was.
Now, this is an interesting question about international law. For that shoal then to sink back down beneath the surface, as soon as it goes below the surface of the ocean, it no longer is an ownable, contestable piece of land. It somehow...
Yeah, there's a magic thing at sea level.
It touches the sky and it becomes a place you can plant a flag, but...
Because there's all kinds of law that revolves around, you know, how far out to sea territoriality goes, right? So suddenly a new dot appearing would totally change that diagram.
But you couldn't build a 25-foot tower on top of it and call it the United Kingdom?
I guess it has to be actual. Could you do it with earth moving? Like if it was just like a foot from the surface, could like some Italians go build a sandcastle?
Right. It's an interesting quirk of maritime law that it's got to be if it's only four pebbles. I mean, this is I guess one of those logic questions. If it's one pebble above the sea, isn't an island? If not, how many pebbles does an island require?
There definitely is a case where, for political purposes, piles of stones have been placed on mountaintops to make sure that one peak is higher than another.
Right. Just like the radio tower on the top of the Sears building or whatever, does it make it the tallest building in the world?
Right. Italy is more concerned about the status of Fernandea than any other country. I guess they learned their lesson in 1831, and they do not want to get scooped by the British again. So today, with there was some volcanic activity in 2000 and 2002 that's really looks very similar to what happened in 1831, and in the hopes that Ferdinandea the Shoal could rise again, Italy decided to get ahead of the curve this time, and they sent divers down to plant a flag with the Sicilian flag, which, by the way, is one of the weirder flags. Can you picture the Sicilian flag? It's like the Isle of Man flag with the propeller made of human legs.
Right.
But this one has Medusa's head in the middle.
Right.
So it's a real, I mean, that's the kind of flag that really says, that's not about national pride. That's like, stay away.
Yeah, right. It's a thing that you would put on a sarcophagus of nuclear waste, right?
Yeah, like it looks like a fallout shelter sign.
If you're a futureling and you see a flag like that and don't understand any other iconography, you're going to go, whatever that was, I don't want to wake it up.
I like that Sicily's destiny as a like organized crime destination is foreshadowed
right.
in its flag. Like, this flag is, we're dangerous.
But stay I feel away. Like it could also be, it's a little bit like some of the iconography around the nation of Macedonia. There's a little bit of a feeling that you would like to retain some independence and connect yourself to ancient times. Because there are people around you that are like, well, Macedonia is not really a thing. Right. Sicily's just part of Italy, right? And you're like, no.
Yeah, they seem to have really had that in mind. They got one of these surviving Bourbon noblemen, you know, this guy named Prince Carlo.
Of course.
Who would be some Bourbon principe if that were still a thing.
Right.
And they got him to come to the ceremony. Italian TV filmed them like making sure there's a marble plaque and a flag now on the summit of Ferdinandia, just in case it comes up again.
20 feet below the surface.
Yes, this is well under the surface of the Mediterranean, 25 feet down. But it says, this piece of land, once Ferdinandia, belonged and shall always belong to the Sicilian people.
Hear, hear. So, it's like that place, that little island between Iceland and Greenland that Denmark and Canada keep fighting over, right?
Yeah, and it's funny that it's not really appealing to the Italian national pride. It's really Sicilians. It's like, people in this local fishing village, guess what? This little dot will be yours if it ever comes up again. So they're ready. They have pre-colonized Ferdinandea, should it ever come back. I think the plaque has since been... since been cracked and vandalized, maybe. Course, I don't know if it's fishing fleets or just...
sea monsters.
Possibly sea monsters. But it's a popular scuba destination.
Right.
Because
it's
so close to the surface. And it's near a picturesque Italian coast. But it is kind of funny to imagine that if Ferdinandea does rise again, Brigadoon style, maybe the flag will come first.
And that will be the first thing there.
It'll be lifted from below.
That's why they did it, right? It pre-claims itself.
I hope they have a webcam for that, because wouldn't that be awesome if you could see it happening in real time?
I wonder if nations employ a certain amount of, or a certain, like, maybe every nation has one geologist that's aware of all the places on the earth where an island might appear and has like a red phone or something to call the Navy and say, get over there. Like, 3 days from now, there's going to be an island and you want to get your flag in it first.
That would be a great job. Monitoring.
Right.
You're essentially an obstetrician, but for islands.
And that concludes Ferdinandea. Entry 461.RV1620, certificate number 50204, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are an inhabitant of Ferdinandia and didn't know the history of the formation of your nation.
You're always like, why is this flag here?
Yeah.
Why is it all wet?
What is this head of Medusa? We are proud to have brought you a little closer to the history of your place and time. You can examine our place and time by going into the time machine function on your future computers and examine our social media accounts. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. I should also say that on Twitter, there is an account called Omnibus Out of Context, which often takes quotes from our episodes out of context, as the name suggests, and publishes them to hilarious effect. Ken and I both follow Omnibus out of context and kind of rejoice in the fact that we often can't tell which of us said the thing.
I feel like maybe one time out of four, I'm sure, and another one time out of four, I have a pretty good sense of who it is.
We each have...
And then I'm just guessing the other half of the time.
Yeah, we each have kind of characteristic turns of phrase, but a lot of times the joke or the out-of-context statement could have come from either of our mouths, which makes the account even more hilarious. If you want to see Ken being hilarious on Twitter, you can go to @KenJennings. By the time you hear this, it's possible that I will have resumed posting angry screeds on Twitter @JohnRoderick.
I'll keep you away.
But I am on Instagram making merry at the same locale, @JohnRoderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can frolic with other fans of the program on Facebook and a subreddit and Discord and wherever else postal stamps are sold. Those are all under the Futurelings moniker. You can mail us things. Ken is going through our mailbag right now. I notice there's a bag over there with three bottles of hot sauce that you keep not revealing, and now suddenly you're holding one in your hand. I can't wait to see what it is.
So, Nate, I guess because you slandered banana sauce.
Wait a minute. I don't think I slandered it. I just imagined it. I imagined what spaghetti with banana sauce would be.
You were not unequivocally in favor of putting banana ketchup on spaghetti. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong.
I've had spaghetti with ketchup on it, normal ketchup, and it's not as good as what we think of as spaghetti sauce.
Well, Nate has sent us three bottles of Filipino banana sauce, which is red.
That's exciting. Well, I knew it was red.
I guess ingredients, water, sugar, banana, cornstarch, vinegar, salt, onion, chili, garlic, and yellow and red colorings.
It's like sriracha, except made of bananas.
Do you think it... Does it taste banana-y?
We have three bottles of it now. We can, you can take one, I'll take
we're
one.
We're going to find out.
Wait, you're the one that throws parties. Why don't you have a party at your house and Mindy can use banana sauce to make a dish?
Mindy is now part of a club that gets together once a month and they make dishes from all over the world. And they're going in alphabetical order.
How long till we get to the Philippines? A while.
It's going to be years, because they go once a month. It's going to be like between 10 and 15 years before they get to the Philippines.
Can't we jump
They're on Angola.
Can we
they're
jump
doing
the queue?
Antigua and Barbuda this month.
Hmm.
So we're not going to get to... But Nate recommends that we put this on rice, spam, and eggs, a classic Filipino breakfast. And somebody... I guess you requested currency at some point, so some of these envelopes have weird currencies in them. Eric sent you so we each get one so we don't fight over them. Hellbank Corporation money.
Those are fake.
You don't think the Hellbank is a real... Did your dad found the Hellbank Corporation?
They're from Asia, or at least pretend to be.
I think they are fake from Asia.
Yeah.
Although it does list on the back putatively Asian officers of this agency.
They look like they were made on a color copier. Am I wrong?
No, they were definitely made on a color copier.
Okay.
So I think we might have more fake currency in here. Oh, and 10-year-old Murphy drew this delightful cartoon of me winning on Jeopardy, an orange marker.
How wonderful, Murphy. Thank you for listening and celebrating Ken.
It's got me losing to Watson. Here's Watson the computer. Here's Alex coming out without his trousers on.
Sure, I celebrate both those moments.
Here's me unable to believe it.
Can't believe it.
You can see by the arrow that says still unable to believe it.
Yeah.
This is really seeing my life in orange smelly marker.
Oh, does it smell like marker or does it smell like orange?
I don't know. I thought it might be one of those things where, you know, the
sniff.
The blue smells like raspberry or whatever.
Famous blue fruit, the raspberry.
I don't even like that. It's because red was already taken, basically. Red already has strawberry and cherry, so they had to give raspberry a new color.
Right, I see.
And light blue didn't have anything, but it's dumb.
It's also the sexiest of all the fruit. That's why it gets blue.
You think raspberry, let me get this straight, you think raspberry is the sexiest fruit?
No, probably peach is the peach is the sexiest fruit, but I don't want a peach and peanut butter sandwich. I want a raspberry jam and peanut butter sandwich.
I see. So and you want a peach in the sheets, but a raspberry in the streets.
Exactly.
Got it.
Oh, also, you can support great moments like these at our Patreon. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject. Donate even a pittance, although, of course, if you can donate more than a pittance, don't feel limited to a pittance.
Donate a pottance, a full pot of money.
And have access to all of our fantastical bonus content, where we do effectively this, open the mail, except we open mail and argue with you about it instead of just celebrate your banana ketchup.
If you love the long, meandering outros of this show, we now do one for money. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization will survive. The map will change. We hope and pray that it won't happen in catastrophic fashion. We hope it'll be in gradual, erosive, Pangea-building kinds of processes. But if that catastrophe we fear comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, could very well be our final word to you. But if Providence allows, we hope to return to you soon with another entry in the Omnibus.